And I'm an addict. And I'm really happy to be here. This is my first WSLD experience. It's been an incredible experience. I'm from the East Coast, and getting to come over to the West Coast is such a privilege. And to meet so many new people and find out how services are done over in the Western states, where there's a tremendous amount of experience, has been a great privilege for me. I want to thank Dave and the host committee for asking me to speak today. Tell you a little bit about myself. So I'm from New York. My clean date is September 10th, 1984. And I was one of those, you ever see those really young people come in the rooms and you're like, wow, that's a really young person. I hope they stay. So I was one of those really young people at the time. I was 17 years old. I got clean 3 weeks before my 18th birthday. And that was in New York. Before that happened, I'd moved around a little bit. I actually left home when I was 14. I left school. And I wanted to come to the West Coast, which is the dream of pretty much everyone on the East Coast. We want what you got. And I literally hitchhiked my way across the country and wound up in, well, I was headed to Washington State. I know Bonner's still here. It rocked. I went to a rainbow gathering in the Okanagan National Forest, spent a month in the forest. It was a lot of fun. Went to Yakima and Spokane. I remember these places I went to, made my way down Eugene and got to California, which was just like, you know, Mecca to come here, and landed in Berkeley, which they called it Berserkly at the time. And, you know, and I found my crowd to hang out with, which was the tarot card readers on Channing Way, and that was where I lived for a while. And I was just sort of one of these street hippies, a young street hippie, living out there in California, sleeping outdoors and enjoying the constant warm weather. It was a great experience. And it was all a lot of fun, obviously, until the powders came along. And I ended up making my way back east and trying life again. While I was out here, I changed my name a couple of times. I turned 15 in the Santa Cruz County Jail, or whatever they call it, in Santa Cruz over there. And so I got a tour of a few facilities over here, even though I was very young. And I'm actually still trying to get that off my record, believe it or not. I discovered it was there. There was no computers back then. That was like 1981. But anyway, some agencies in California kept the prints and sent them into D.C., and I'm struggling to get rid of that stuff now, believe it or not. In any case, I ended up making my way back east. I was living in the Boston region at that point, and doing my thing over there, I realized that school was probably a good thing. As a female, I probably wasn't going to make it as a big-time drug dealer in California. So maybe I would go back to high school and finish that up. And I did that in the great state of Massachusetts because it was too old to go back to school in New York. There was like a competitive school system there, and I was like non-competitive. Couldn't get in. So Massachusetts accepted me. I finished things over there and got myself in some trouble with the law there. Those were the early days of the first narcotics task forces, and got involved in one of those things and wound up in the newspapers and got 86 from every place there. Became, when they found out I was underage, I was just like 86 from every place, no friends, nowhere to go. So I went back home to New York, and I knew at the time, actually before I went home from New York, my father, who is an alcoholic, had started making meetings in the Alcoholics Anonymous Fellowship. And I had told him, I said, you know, it's possible that I might have a problem. While this court thing's going on, I'm going to, try to lay low and stop getting into trouble. And he called the helpline or the hotline in Massachusetts at the region over there and had them send a meeting list to my house. And that was how I found out about Narcotics Anonymous. His meeting list just magically showed up in my mailbox. You know, some trusted servant somewhere was answering the phone and was kind enough to, you know, put a meeting list in an envelope, address it, put a stamp, take it to a mailbox and send it to this little girl's apartment where I was living by myself in Brookline, and I got this meeting list. And so that was my first exposure to NA, and I started making meetings there in Boston. And there weren't many meetings to make. As far as I can recall, there was like a meeting on Bowdoin Street, and that was like all we had at the time back there. And so we had a make the other fellowship because there just weren't that many meetings back then. And of course I found the crowd that was still, you know, using after the meeting and during the break and all that kind of stuff. And I had missed the part about the total abstinence and about alcohol being a drug. I mean, I just, you know, I'd missed that. But I was still counting days. I was still counting days because I thought that was how it worked. And I was avoiding the hard stuff and certain things, and I thought that would be good enough. So I moved back home to New York and to the Greenwich Village where I grew up. And the meetings, there was only one meeting in the West Village back then, so we have to walk over to the East Village to St. Mark's Place where the meetings were. And this big Puerto Rican guy took my white chip when he found out that I was drinking and counting days at the same time. And he said, no, in New York, it's total absence. That's what we do in Narcotics Anonymous. And if you want what we have, you know, then you'll do what we do. So it took me about 13 days to think about that. You know, was I going to make a commitment? Was I going to make this decision? Right? And the word decision implies action. I thought about it, and after 13 days, you know, I got myself a white chip. I surrendered, and I've been here ever since. It was a great time to get clean in New York. It was a very exciting era. You know, we were not as fortunate as California and some of the other states. It was illegal for two addicts to congregate in New York until 1981, when they stopped enforcing that law. So we didn't have Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And if you tried something, you definitely were under surveillance at that point. But what we had was a man who moved up from Florida, where he had been making Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and he opened up our first meeting in Queens in April 1983, and at the same time, somebody opened one up in the Bronx in April of 1983. Nobody really knows which one was first. And those were our two meetings in 1983. And I rolled around in 1984, and we had more than two meetings. No, that was 1981 they started them. Right, in 1983, the World Convention came. So what happened was these two meetings grew, and more people were getting attracted to Narcotics Anonymous, and they reached out to World Services and said, you know, like, hey, we finally are allowed to have meetings here. Can you send us some literature? What do we do? And of course, World Services sent, you know, tons of literature to us, helped us start out and sent us to the region. I think there was like one region for pretty much the whole East Coast at that point. It was the Mid-Atlantic region. And so it was New York City area, and we were part of that region. And California people came over. Remember Bob Stone and George and like all sorts of people from California were coming over to help us form a service structure. And we went from being a New York City area to becoming the New York region into the greater New York region. And we started that in 1983, right after the World Convention happened in New York. And that was the big explosion of Narcotics Anonymous in New York, when World Services and everybody came over to attend the convention and support that. So the fellowship was rather small at that point, getting bigger every single day. And you know, and I walked in 84 into that wonderful environment where we were growing something for the first time that nobody had had. Nobody had had this opportunity. Obviously, there were no therapeutic communities back then. There was no rehabs. There was none of that stuff. You could go to like detox at Bernstein. That was about it. There was no place to go. So if you wanted to get clean, you did it in your chair. You know, you came to a meeting and this was the place where we could get clean. So that was the environment that I walked into. And it was a very exciting environment. And again, things were small then. We had competing fellowships. There was like Cocaine Anonymous and Drugs Anonymous and Pills Anonymous. It was like all of these 12-step fellowships were like, you know, trying to form themselves in New York, since it suddenly became legal to have meetings for addicts to go to. And I checked all of these other things out, these different fellowships out when I first moved there. But it was when I saw the first step of Narcotics Anonymous and talked about the disease of addiction that I knew that I had found my home, that you guys knew that it was much bigger than my drug use, that you know that there was a problem inside that I needed help with, and that you could help me with that, that you understood that you'd been there and you were staying clean today and recovering from the disease of addiction. And so all of that went into my thinking when I made that commitment to stay clean a day at a time and join the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. So it was a lot of fun back then. We didn't have key tags or anything like that. We had white chips that we bought from Woolworths. And you know, white was surrender, and then there was red, you know, warning you're not cured for 90 days, and the blue one for blue skies at 6 months. And that was what we had. And I was really excited to become a secretary. And you can become a secretary when you had 90 days clean. And I knew I wanted to be secretary and go to Woolworths and buy the poker chips. And what we did with the poker chips was you scotch taped the dime on one side and your sponsor's number on the other side. And the dime, of course, was for the phone booth in case you wanted to pick up You would have the white chip in your pocket. You would have, you know, at least 10 cents left on you to make that phone call, and you're supposed to put your sponsor's phone number on the other side. So I had to find myself a sponsor. And there were not that many women to choose from sponsors at the time. It seemed like, so everything was very, very early in recovery. So people who had like pure NA clean time were basically around a year and a half clean, 2 years clean. And that was everybody. If you had more than 4 years clean, you came from another state or another fellowship, which was perfectly fine. It was just, you know, everybody had small amounts of clean time then. And so the women on St. Mark's Place, the choices were pretty much by hair color. We had like the purple-haired crowd, this woman with the purple hair, and she was really rock and roll and cool and beautiful, and all our sponsees had purple hair. And I'm serious. And it was big. This is the 80s. This was big purple hair. And then we had the redheaded chick, and she was the tough biker chick, and you know, all her sponsees had like shades of red or piece of red in her hair, and she was the tough biker babe. And then we had the woman with the dark hair, and she was a public information chair of the Greater New York region, and her sponsees all, we didn't dye her hair and stuff. So I went to her, and I asked her if she would be my sponsor, and actually back then. The way it was is they said no until you had 90 days. You couldn't get a sponsor until you had 90 days clean, and that was just the normal tough love. And I remember she said, I don't want to waste my time. If you're serious about this, then, you know, you'll get your 90 days, and I'll say yes to you at that point. We'll see if you do that. So you can imagine I was pretty annoyed, you know, taking a lot of courage to walk up to this woman in the first place. So, you know, I got in her face at 90 days and asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes. And she's been sponsoring me for a very, very long time, for many, many years since then. I wanted to get a basic text. I talked to her about it, and at the time, I remember she said, well, you know, the third edition is going to be coming out soon, and it's going to be really wonderful. And she said, just hold out. Don't buy the text we have now. Just hold out. Wait till we get that third edition. And I waited, and I got the third edition. Actually, it was a gift from her, and she signed my book. That was December of 84. I was able to get that one. And so at that time on St. Mark's Place, I think we had 44 meetings in the entire region of Greater New York. About 22 of them were in Manhattan itself, which is where I was from. And to make meetings 7 days a week, I think prior to that you had to, you know, get on the subways and get onto to different boroughs if you wanted to make a meeting every single day. And so we started adding meetings on St. Mark's Place. We also had Bleecker Street on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And my home group was the 8th Street Workshop on Monday nights at St. Mark's. And I remember we were so proud. And that was one of the characteristics that I remember most about the early days, was how proud we were to have our own language and our own fellowship. And we were still getting our language together. We closed with the Lord's Prayer back then. We had the shades up that, you know, the shades looked like the shades. And we were still figuring a lot of things out. And everybody on the region, which is pretty much the crowd I ended up, where I got involved with my service, was sponsored by, you know, somebody on the trustees, somebody on the board of directors. You know, we were getting all of our information from California as to how to do our services, how to work our steps. You know, there was no step working guide or anything like that. So it was sort of coming down from these lineages of these, you know, sponsor lines, how to work the steps and how to work the program of Narcotics Anonymous. So my sponsor also told me, you know, if you're going to be my sponsee, you have to do service. And that was not a problem. I was very attracted to service. And at that time, getting a group level service position was competitive. You couldn't become a GSR alternate if you tried. It was about 3 or 4 people available for every single position. You had to present your qualifications at the business meeting, go out in the hallway, glare at each other, and, you know, pray and hope that you got elected to something. And you had to go to like group to group to try to find something. We had a H&I rep at every meeting. We had a PI rep at every meeting. And our business meetings were long, and we discussed everything that was going on, everything in the car, every subcommittee, you know, every group. We were all on top of it. And you had to work hard to find an open commitment and see if you were lucky enough to get into that. So I went to a Manhattan area service, and which was meeting around there. Well, actually, it wasn't Manhattan Area Shared, it was MBSI. It was Manhattan, Brooklyn, Staten Island. And that's another thing that was going on. It was a lot of growing pains. And it was a wonderful thing, and it was a painful thing at the same time. So our areas were splitting and dividing every year because NA was just exploding in New York. And, you know, bridges and tunnels, and people have cars, and a lot of people don't have cars and stuff. And it becomes difficult to move around, and you end up with so many people at the area services. So MBSI became M and BSI, and then B and SI and M, and then, you know, B has divided and M has divided, and all of these things have divided up over the years as the region has grown. But anyway, so MBSI in those days, really they were throwing chairs. There really was fist, you know, it was really a crazy sort of environment as we were trying to figure things out. We took everything personally. It was like our responsibility to protect the program of Narcotics Anonymous, to protect the fellowship. The reputation that we were trying to establish. I mean, we didn't have any. We were some crazy people, I can assure you of that. And so area was a little intense. And my sponsor was the regional PI chair. And one day she says to me, she says, you can type, right? I said, yeah, of course I can type. That was one thing I had actually learned in high school in Massachusetts, how to type. And she said, you're going to be the new regional secretary. And she took me out to the region. And I remember she said to me, I don't know where Dave is, she said, don't wear all that black. Don't wear all that black clothing at the region. So people come from all over the state, wear colors. And so I went out. I had 15 months clean at the time. So that was the end of 85. And there was a woman who was the secretary from at the region. And she was a Las Vegas showgirl, a big, tall, blonde lady with the eyelashes and the assets and everything. And we were told that she was a friend of Jimmy. And she was originally from Oklahoma, but she couldn't type, right? So she had all of the minutes written down, but no minutes ever went out anywhere. So she had stopped showing up even. They gave me all of her handwritten minutes and stuff. And, you know, I was honored to get elected regional secretary. And I think that might have been like the proudest moment, you know, of my life at that time, was being allowed to serve, you know, at that region. And maybe it was a quiet position, and I wrote everything down, but I took it very seriously. I had the white out in the different colors. I had the carbon paper. I had an IBM Selectric typewriter. That was the real deal at the time. I actually started college when I was 4 days clean. I started going to college, and I had received this typewriter as a gift. And I went to college across the street from my elementary school, and it was in between my house and the East Village, so it's all very, very convenient. Manhattan's actually a rather small place, you know, and you can just walk to everything there. So, so we used carbon paper back in the day. I had correction tape, the whole bit. My minutes were 23 pages, single space. I typed everything. My minutes were good. They loved me. Mailed these things out. We went to the Xerox store, and you know, I don't know what my budget was at the time. Mailed everything out, and not surprisingly, eventually they waived policy. They wanted to keep me on as being the secretary. Didn't care about clean time, term limits, nothing. A woman willing to type is a great virtue. So I did that for a few years, and you know, the region to me, it was like being around spiritual giants. That's exactly how it felt. I mean, I was a young person, so everybody at the region was like 10 years older than me and clean, you know, 5 years and 4 years and stuff like that. But they were all members of world-level subcommittees. They were all sponsored by people out in California. They were getting like the direct information and bringing it, you know, home to New York and telling us how you guys do things out here. And so it was an amazing environment. We used to have dances to help raise money for our region. They were called the Pioneer Dance, and we felt like we were pioneers. You know, we felt like we were breaking into new territory, new ground, something never been done before where we were from. You know, and so I was secretary for some number of years, and then I formed our archives. Oh, the first thing, when you hit 90 days in New York back then, you got to do all sorts of service opportunities. So first, I became the secretary, and I think on the 90th day, I was brought to speak at my first H&I meeting. It scared me to death. They were all nodding out. I don't think anybody heard anything I said. I was still scared to death anyway. And they brought me to the hotline, because when you had 90 days clean, you could work the hotline. And we had a real phone system in an office that we leased, which was our regional service office. there on St. Mark's. You had live addicts answering the phone. Once you had 90 days clean, you could do that, and that was a wonderful thing. And our next regional service office moved to 12th Street, which was up the street from my college, and I would go to school, and then I would go to do my shift, you know, at the hotline and do my homework there. I'd be there all evening, you know, working between phone calls and such. And to this day, we still have live addicts answering the phone in Greater New York. So we got to do lots of service once you hit the 90-day mark there. And my favorite was, you know, serving at the Greater New York region. So after all the secretarying stuff and creating the archives, I got elected the regional chair, which is you know, a lot of pressure there. So at that point, we had something like 14 areas. We were growing wildly. We were talking about incorporating our convention. We formed the RSO and the board of directors over there. There's a lot of stuff going on, and areas were no longer splitting because they were so large. They're starting to split because of resentments, and you know, people would break up, and these would be my meetings here, and these would be your meetings over here, and me and my sponsees will have this area, and you and yours will have that one, and things got really intense there. And at that point, after I chaired the region for a couple of years, I took a break from that, and you know, I had was focused on career. And trying to see if I could find like a normal guy in New York, normal guy. At that point, I was working in the television industry, and I started working long hours and traveling out to LA a lot. There was a lot of travel involved, and it was starting to get difficult to do service and the job. So I started to focus on my job for a bit, and relationships were impossible, in part because I was really young, but I took it very personally. I remember I bought an apartment when I was 23 years old. I was confident I was going to be single for the rest of my life. I had not met Mr. Right by the age of 23, so that was it. I was surrendering, you know, I'm done. I've tried. And I was very serious young person. So anyway, so I did that for television stuff for a while, and then did, of course, end up getting married. I was shortly after the second Woodstock Festival. I live up by the second Woodstock Festival. None of them were actually ever in Woodstock, just so you know. but the second Woodstock Festival was in the town next to Woodstock, and I ended up working that. That was like a massive event, and that was like a lot of fun, and somehow after that, somehow I'm not sure how the first husband relates to that, but that all happened around that same time there. And pretty much everybody who grows up in the city. So, you know, I mean, I was like a poor Manhattan mutt. I'm half Puerto Rican and half Jewish, so I didn't fit in with the Puerto Ricans. I didn't fit in with the Jews. I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. I was just a public school kid who grew up in tiny apartments and, you know, hung out in the fire escape to try to stay cool during the summertime. And my parents slept in the living room because we only had, I mean, if you had one bedroom, that was pretty good. And I forget where I was going with that, but what we do want to do is we want to know what it's like to live in a house and have trees and grass and a dog, because you don't have that kind of stuff. We didn't have that then growing up in the city. So eventually, after, you know, I was clean a good length of time, I moved up an hour and a half north of the George Washington Bridge to the country, and that's where I live now, in a little town called Saugerties, which is right next to Woodstock, New York. Wow. Close, but just a little bit of distance. So that was a big shocking change, in service. If anybody's ever moved in service, that was the outermost area of my region, because I didn't want to change regions. I had to stay, you know, within. And so the first marriage, he relapsed. You know, they invented new stuff that we had just become unaware of. You know, I became a little bit oblivious in some of the changes in pharmaceuticals and things that were being invented that we didn't have, you know, back in the 80s. And my husband ended up getting, you know, overprescribed all sorts of stuff when he had broken his collarbone. And our marriage didn't end up surviving that relapse. You know, we hung in there for like a few years, but we ended up going, you know, our separate ways at that point. So there I was, like, living in the middle of nowhere where it's all dark. What do? Go back to the region, right? I called up the region. I said, do you have any open positions? Is there something that I can do, you know? And I think I ended up there like, we need a vice chair. Come back down. And I got back involved with regional service again. And I think that's always a saved my life, you know? to a great extent. All the different service positions I've ever had have just been the most wonderful experience, most wonderful people I have met through service. So anyhow, I did the vice chair, I chaired the region again, and then I got involved with public relations and trying to bring the umbrella movement to New York, which was, they weren't having it. They had it so long as I was there, but once I was done with that, they were like, she's gone, we can separate them again, you know, and I don't think that lasted. I did the public relations and H&I. Oh, so that was another thing that happened when I moved in upstate New York. They didn't have H&I. And I was not an H&I type of a girl. I had never been involved with other than like little things in California when I was really young. But I mean, I had like no correctional experience. Nobody in my family had any correctional experience. But I knew that we reach addicts through H&I. And if you have an NA community and you have area service, you got to have H&I. They didn't have any PI upstate either. So me and this girl, who was also from the city, we looked at each other and said, all right, one of us is going to start PI, one of us is going to start H&I. You know, we're going to create subcommittees up here. And so she got PI, I got H&I. I didn't know what I was doing, but you don't really have to know what you're doing that much. It's all written down in our literature, and World Services has a phone number, and lots of people in any region with tons and tons of service experience. So I formed the H&I subcommittee for my area. And that has also been one of the most gratifying types of service that I've ever done. Even though I don't have any institutional background and I got clean in my chair, what I discovered was that they actually can really use people with good administrative skills. And it doesn't matter, you know, I don't have to be, you know, the person delivering the message in the institution to be of service. And so I started cold calling correctional facilities and offering to, you know, bring Narcotics Anonymous meetings in to recruit men in Narcotics Anonymous to bring the meetings into the facilities. And that went really well. I opened up meetings in four prisons. I got the first New York facility on the Hawaii Convention call, you know how they have the facilities wired in. So that was really exciting for us in New York. And I got dozens and dozens of people involved in that kind of service who had never had, you know, never occurred to them to do that before. You know, we had people, a lot of men, who could deliver an incredible message of recovery. They had, you know, come from all sorts of, you know, backgrounds and a lot of correctional experience, but they couldn't make, you know, phone calls during the business hours, the paperwork, the tuberculosis test. I mean, just the requirements to get clear to go into these facilities are basically designed to keep volunteers out. You know, that's how it is where I come from. They are not helpful if you want to go into a facility to bring a message. So, you know, in bounces along Little Miss Cheerful over here, right, with all my little administrative skills. And I, at the time, was self-employed. And so I had no problem going in and meeting, you know, with the superintendents or the depths of programs and all of that, and bringing, you know, the guys from NA and driving them in and introducing them and getting them into these commitments. So this was, you know, some of the service experience that I've had over the years. And of course, I joined the regional H&I committee so I could get some direction and guidance as to what I was doing, since I didn't actually know what I was doing. So I also learned that from my regional H&I subcommittee. And as the years went on, so that made a big impression on my life, getting involved with corrections. And I ended up leaving, you know, the entertainment business behind, and I became a prisoner advocate professionally. Started off as a volunteer with that, so all my service in NA taught me how to be, you know, a volunteer with nonprofits. And I got involved with prisoner advocacy, and then I ended up getting hired at my state legislature to help try to change laws in my state to make things better for, you know, the addicts behind the wall, and hopefully get them out, you know, and get them out. So, and that's what I do to this day, and I continue to work on prisoner issues. So. So yeah, service has changed my life in so many different ways. And then through that sort of advocacy work, I met the man that became my second husband, who himself was incarcerated for many, many years. Obviously, he got out, and some of you know him. He's not here on this trip. He wishes that he were. And he has been a tremendous blessing in my life, I can tell you that. And so from service at the regional level there, the second whole, you know, batch of different things I did, from there, I used to go to Marlikna a lot. I still do. I go to Marlikna every single year. I've been doing that, like, most of my recovery. And somebody told me about the Whirlpool information form, and they said, you know, why don't you fill out one of these forms and submit it, and maybe you will get a call. And I had not been familiar with that form. You know, I've been very focused on the kind of service that I've been doing, but I filled it out, and, you know, all my little service resume, and I put down references and people who knew me, had been around a long time and had done world service. And eventually I got a phone call, much to my amazement. Somebody actually called from Sam's Club at the time, shopping, doing a little groceries, and I get this call from the WSO asking me if I'd like to be involved with a work group. And I said, sure, I would be involved with a work group. That sounds good to me. And so that was the service system work group, and I was a part of that work group, which was an incredible experience. It was all RDs. I was actually the only one who wasn't an RD. It was the RDs from Colorado and Minnesota and Brazil and Australia and Florida and Northern California. And it was just an amazing group of people. And I was intimidated, I can tell you that. I was highly intimidated by what seemed to me to be another group of just spiritual giants, people who love Narcotics Anonymous so much and had been doing all sorts of world-level services for years, attending conferences for years and trying to make services better, not only in the communities that they came from, but on a worldwide level, trying to influence, you know, the global reputation and availability of the NA message and the NA program. So this was just, I was really, I was fearful and humble and so excited and proud to be a part of that work group and part of these services, work with all of the delegates. And I think the stuff that came out of that work group is phenomenal. As the years go on, more and more, I say, you know what, we had some great ideas, we had some great materials. Check it out on NA.org there. And so from there, you know, just going along on the service line, and then after that, I was elected to the World Board in 2012, and that's the capacity in which I serve now at World Services, and then where I live, of course, I'm still treasurer at my home group, and I'm the speaker booker at my other home group. I got two home groups where I live. It's a good thing. And and so here it is, years later. I have I just had my anniversary in September. I had 32 years clean. Thank you. And it's still a weird thing. Then 3 weeks later, I turned 50, which I was obsessing about since I turned 49. You know, not to project or anything, but it was, you know, it's like, oh my God. And so, you know, and it's a long time. There's still many years ahead in which to screw up, right? There's a lot of years in front of me still. I'm not, you know, I'm not as young as I used to be, but I'm not that old either. There's a lot of opportunity there. And so, you know, because of that, I make sure that I stick close. And I live like in the boonies. You know, now my husband and I talk about things like, you think the bears are going to come out? Is it too soon to put out the bird seed? And don't throw the watermelon rinds in the woods, because it always brings the bears when we do that. You know, it's a very different place than where I used to live. You know, and no matter what, I make sure I stay involved with home group, that I have a home group, I have a group level service, you know, because I don't ever want to you know, fade away, disappear, which seems like something that's so easy to happen. I've seen it to a lot of people over the years. I think we've all seen that, where there's been people whom we've known for, you know, decades, or who had decades clean, you know, and somehow stop making meetings, stop using a sponsor, stop being of service, you know, and it never ended well for any of those people. So, you know, I try to keep it and keep doing everything like I did when I was a newcomer. You know, everything I learned, just like everything I learned in kindergarten, all still applies today. Everything that I was told when I was a newcomer, to stay close to my home group, have a service commitment, stay close to my sponsor. That woman deserves a medal. Decades of listening to me complain. And this has just been the most incredible experience of my life, to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I feel like I grew up here, because I basically did grow up here, you know. And sometimes there's been there's occasions, there were some years where I felt like, you know, I was lacking some verbal boundaries. I remember telling like my in-laws about some of my drug use, and I was like, I probably, that's not a good idea. I did not need to be that honest, you know, with them on that particular point. So I continue to grow. I continue to grow here in NA, continue to do, you know, my step work and work closely with all of my sponsees, and I continue to learn so much from the service opportunities that we have here, for which I'm very grateful. So I hope I've said something of interest. I hope you've gotten to know me a little bit more. I appreciate that you've allowed that. I feel like I'm getting to know a lot of you guys here as I get to go to these different service events and at the conference and the car workshops. And thank you for allowing me to share.